Music fans are remembering Don Cornelius, host of Soul Train. He died in Los Angeles yesterday in apparent suicide at age 75. Cornelius was famous for his impeccable clothes, his afro, and his baritone voice. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports Cornelius was multicultural long before most Americans knew that word.
Don Cornelius did not like it when you called Soul Train the black version of American Bandstand. He was right to object. For one thing, Soul Train was way hipper. And for another, it was far more inclusive than many other shows aimed at teens. He made Soul Train for black kids, but everybody, as the OJs like to sing, was invited to get on board. Until Soul Train, there hadn't been a dance show aimed at a black market. When I interviewed him in 2010, Cornelius said he saw a niche.
After a short time on radio, the first thing I began to really notice is that there was no black television. That television was just white this, white that, general market this, white that.
So he created a show that would allow black teens to see themselves. Drummer Amir Questlove Thompson of The Roots explains what that meant to him growing up.
The show is very important because historically it's one of the first shows that sold us Afrocentricity.
Even the ads on Soul Train were tailored to black consumers, like this one with a Swahili chorus for the hairstyling product Afrosheen. Cornelius had exactly the right show at exactly the right time. Young Americans were finding commonality across race, grooving to some of the same music, wearing some of the same clothes. Don Cornelius became an unwitting ambassador from the world of black soul. But he was an ambassador, not a despot. The main prerequisite for appearing as a guest or a dancer on Soul Train was this. You had to have soul. Period. So in addition to The Temptations and Aretha Franklin, the Jackson 5 and Curtis Mayfield, Soul Train featured white guests like the Ohio band Wild Cherry. And a group of rockin' Scots with the cheek to call themselves the Average White Band. When disco threatened to make funk and R&B irrelevant, Cornelius regrouped quickly with Donna Summer. Followed by Barry White, the Bee Gees, and others. And the beat went on. Soul Train was on air for almost four decades and continues in syndication, so Don Cornelius and his hip, elegant image will remain with us. Think about him the next time you're at a wedding and they do the Soul Train line. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a minute, we'll hear what kind of music Oscar nominee Viola Davis likes to listen to. That's coming up. But first, it's time for our Wisdom Watch conversation. That's the part of the program where we speak with those who have made a difference through their work. And today, we want to talk with somebody who has made a difference in how we work it. You may recognize that as RuPaul's 1992 dance hit Supermodel. Ever since then, RuPaul has been acclaimed as an entertainer, singer, and model. He is known for his glamorous dresses, sky-high wigs, and even higher heels. Now, at age 51, he hosts his own modeling competition for drag queens. RuPaul's Drag Race on the Logo Network opened its fourth season last week, and the episode scored the highest ratings of any premiere in Logo history. And RuPaul joins us now to talk about his work and his life and whatever else is on his mind. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And RuPaul really is your name.
Yes, my real name.
RuPaul Andre Charles, if I have that right.
Yes, yes. My folks are from southern Louisiana, so I have a Creole background. And the roux is literally is the roux in a gumbo, the gravy that you make before you make a gumbo.
And your mom said, you say in your bio that your mom gave you that name because she knew that you would be a star.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Why did she think that?
I don't know. You know, she was very intuitive, and, you know, people from that part of the country claim to be very intuitive, and I believe them. So I grew up with that, and I knew that I would be. I didn't know it'd be doing drag, that's for sure.
How did you get into drag?
Well, I was in a punk rock band in Atlanta, Georgia, and we were, this is the Reagan 80s, and we were into trying to sort of push the envelope. And somebody suggests we do a gig in drag, just because it's really in our culture the last taboo for boys. And we did it. And the reaction I got was outrageous. So I thought, interesting. I'll take note of that.
Why do you think that is? Is it in part because you're so tall?
I think there are several reasons. And in hindsight, you know, I come from a family of all girls, and my features are somewhat softer than usual guy features. And you know what? I think it's beshert. I think it's kismet, honestly.
Did it bother you, though, that you have in your bio that you were mistaken for a girl at a young age? And I was wondering, did that used to bother you until you figured out how to work it, work for you?
Well, you know what? It didn't bother me because I knew that people say all kinds of things, and people really aren't that bright. Okay, there, I said it, you know? And I learned that from an early age, too. I thought, okay, I didn't fit in. I'm going to figure out how to fit in. So once I figured out what people were doing and what society was doing, I realized, I don't want to fit into that. I want to stay on the outside of that.
You do, though, say in your memoir, this is not an easy thing. A number of other performers, though, who have an unconventional path to success have also had a difficult time of it. Like, for example, Tyler Perry talks about how, you know, he lived in his car for a time. You went through some really difficult periods like that.
Sure. But I think it's difficult even if you don't choose to follow your bliss. It's difficult if you choose to do what other people want you to do. Life is not easy. And I, you know, it's a pet peeve with me with, you know, a culture where we want to make the world baby safe for kids. It's like, well, you know, kiddo, you can't make it baby safe because we've set it up to where suffering and pain is a part of life. And that's okay, because there's a way to override that.
Which is what?
Which is to go within and to understand that you are not your body. You are not your circumstances. You can transcend every situation, even, believe it or not, death. And many people have come to this planet to tell you that. You can transcend any of it because it's really all a dream. I don't want to freak people out with this stuff, but hey, that's what's going on here.
Well, but it's interesting because it's a tough message from somebody whose performance aura is associated with beauty and lightness and fun and fizz. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I do know what you mean. But really, the overall commentary on what I'm doing is saying, hey, look, I get to create whatever persona I want to. And it's all up to me. And the truth is, we're all basically the universe pretending to be humans for a brief moment in time with a little self-induced amnesia.
I'm speaking with legendary performer RuPaul. He is a model, singer, entertainer. We're checking in with him for a Wisdom Watch conversation. He's dropping some knowledge on us even as we speak. You know, talking about the fact that you're saying, look, we're all born naked and we're all in drag. We're talking now a lot more than we used to about the transgender experience. You know, people who feel they were born in the wrong body. But that's not you.
No, not at all. Not at all. People have issue with my stance on that, because the truth is, people take themselves too seriously. I think, yeah, okay, you're born in the wrong body, but the truth is, you're not your body. So why take it so seriously, you know? And you know, if it causes you pain, you know, do whatever you want to do. I'm not going to stand in your way, but I don't think it's that serious.
The drag is a performance art. I mean, you identify as a man. You don't see yourself as being other than a man or trapped in your male body or whatever, but the whole drag aura, the wigs, the heels, the fabulous dresses are a performance for you.
Yeah, it's so funny. I answer this question all the time. I don't understand why people have such a problem with it. I know, actually, I do understand why people have a problem.
I don't know that they have a problem with it.
No, it's not a problem. It's understanding the concept. It's mm-hmm. because the ego mind wants you to believe that you are all the things it says on your driver's license or your birth certificate. And so someone who decides, well, I'm going to use all the colors in the crayon box, has to sort of be understood, when the truth is, we're all doing that. And I think drag comes up against opposition because drag queens break the fourth wall. We're basically saying, you are not who you think you are. You're actually much more than that. You know, you follow?
I do. Do you feel that there is more or less tolerance for men who like to dress as women for whatever reason, or for women who like to dress as men? You remember Lady Gaga for one of the big awards mm-hmm. shows, dressed as kind of her alter ego. What did she? I forget who she called it. Joe, somebody. But she dressed and she stayed in character for the whole evening. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about your perception of how that works.
Well, we are a culture who is obsessed with masculine behavior. For a man to dress in what's considered girls' clothes or whatever, that's definitely looked down upon. But for a woman to do it, it's completely different. You know, I've had talk show hosts ask me, so why are you wearing women's clothes? And they, of course, are dressed in slacks, a blazer, and, you know, a button-down shirt. And people don't get it. And the truth is, we're all doing it. But we have a judgment against what's considered feminine or weak.
Curious, though, about RuPaul's Drag Race, because you were quoted a couple of years ago saying that you did not want to do a reality show because you thought they would be demeaning and it would... Demeaning was the word? Did I have the word right?
Well, no. During the Bush administration, there was a hostility toward anyone who was thought outside the box. So there was a certain hostility. And I didn't want to do it if it was going to be mean-spirited or if it was going to be, you know, sort of talked down. But times change and a window of opportunity opened. And that's when we were able to do this TV show. In fact, when I first hit in 92, 93, you know, Clinton was gotten to office and there was a window of openness. And what's strange about that is how quickly these windows close.
Interesting. You want to play a short clip just so we can hear for people who haven't had a chance to hear the show? Here it is.
Wigs will fly.
Berra. Get out.
Shade will be thrown.
Go back to Party City where you belong.
Words will be mispronounced.
We have to make a post-apocalyptic outfit, and I don't know what that means.
This January.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so what do you think? I mean, do you feel, are you opening the window or... What are you doing?
Definitely opening the window. I think there are a lot of people, we're in about 30 countries around the world with this TV show, who are getting an opportunity to find out about a world that they had no idea. And it's not just, sexual deviation. It has to do with using all of the materials that this planet has to offer and opening up and finding areas in your consciousness that need to be open. I love in yoga, my teacher says, you know, find those sticky spots and make space in there. I think that's such a great vision.
Do you envision a time, if you and I were to get together, however long, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20, when a little boy who wanted to wear a dress to school could do it and it wouldn't be big? Wouldn't be huge.
I think there will be a time when that's possible, but I can't believe in my lifetime how we've regressed in certain areas of our consciousness. So I think there will be a time, probably soon, but I think that those, like I said, those windows close very quickly.
Do you ever get tired of dressing up?
No, I don't. I enjoy doing the television show. It's tough doing my nightclub act, which I'm actually going to go back to this year. I hadn't done it in 2 years. It's tough on the road doing it because, because I need so much time and I want to look perfect. There's, you know, on the TV show, we get to control the atmosphere. But now with everybody with their iPhones and their phones in nightclubs, you get all these unflattering pictures everywhere. So that becomes a problem. And I am 51 years old.
Do you ever want to change your look? I mean, that signature platinum wig and the fabulous, you've got the most beautiful lips, of course, ever, and the big eyelashes and the, do you ever want to change your look?
Well, I do change my
look.
You know, those are the... Those are the skills that pay the bills right there. But, you know, that's not my only look in my life. My show business career is what I do for a living. But I have so much more life outside of that. And I change my look all the time. But the signature look, you know, it's like asking Coca-Cola, you're going to change the formula? I don't think so.
Yes, sir. Well put. Well, as we said, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you, and I appreciate it. And we call this segment the Wisdom Watch, where we do ask, do you have some wisdom? And and you can direct that to whomever you wish. I mean, it could be a young you, it could be a young person listening to our conversation who maybe isn't sure where he or she fits in, or just somebody who's just got the creative flair.
Absolutely. And this is my daily mantra, sometimes minute by minute mantra, which is love yourself, learn to love yourself and stay in this moment. This moment right here is where your power is. If you drift into the past or into the future, you lose your power and your ability to love yourself. So this moment right now, be kind and love yourself.
RuPaul is a legendary entertainer. His program, RuPaul's Drag Race, is in its fourth season on the Logo Channel, and he was kind enough to join us from NPR New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Furry forecaster Punxsutawney Phil woke up this morning and saw his shadow, supposedly meaning six more weeks of winter. It's now been 20 years since actor Bill Murray woke up to Sonny and Cher's I've Got You, Babe.
They say we're young and we don't know, won't find out.
For the Illinois town where much of that movie was filmed, reliving Groundhog Day again and again isn't such a bad thing, Jenna Dooley of member station WNIJ reports.
That's right, woodchuckers, it's Groundhog Day! Get up and check!
Groundhog Day wasn't an Oscar darling, but it did make $70 million at the box office and gave new meaning to the term Bing. The lovable but goofy film stars Bill Murray as egotistical Phil Connors, a burnt-out meteorologist doomed to relive the same day over and over until he has a change of heart. It takes an untold number of attempts to finally make it to February 3rd, but while Murray desperately tries to make it to the next day, people here in Woodstock, Illinois are pretty much choosing not to. Chicago native director Harold Ramis was drawn to Woodstock's quaint town square, where many of the scenes were shot in 1992. The bustling town of about 20,000 people is a friendly place with a coffee shop, a bookstore, and an iconic opera house on the square. You might think you were in Mayberry if it weren't for cartoon groundhogs posted on nearly every corner. John Sherris is the managing director of the Woodstock Opera House. In the movie, it's transformed into the Pennsylvania Hotel, but it's someplace entirely different each February.
I use it a lot as a reference point when I'm talking to, you know, agents and people as far as work here, booking acts for the Opera House. I'll tell them, well, you've seen Woodstock, you just didn't know it.
In 1995, a group of locals got together to reminisce about the town's role in the movie. They decided to meet again, same time, every year. From there, the Woodstock Groundhog Days were born. Co-chair Pam Morehouse says one highlight is when the town's own groundhog, Woodstock Willie, predicts the weather. And there are all sorts of souvenirs in the square. Willie even has his own wake-up hot sauce.
For about 4 or 5 days every year, we just kind of go back to the recreation of the film and want to relive it because it was such a positive experience for our community.
There's also a walking tour of film locations. That includes Ned's Corner, where Bill Murray's character runs into the pesky insurance agent, Ned Ryerson.
Now, don't you tell me you don't remember me, because I sure as heck fire remember you.
Not a chance.
Actor Stephen Tobolowsky played Needle Nose Ned. He remembers Woodstock fondly and has taken part in the festivities.
Now I've done lots and lots of movies, and I've never had a film in a community have that kind of bonding experience like Groundhog Day.
Movie extra and local Rick Belairs remembers spending months on the set patiently waiting for his 15 minutes of fame.
There's one scene where I can readily spot myself and point, but don't blink or I'm gone.
For an extra in a film that relives the same day, it meant no costume change.
I've got, you know, an old gray jacket and sweatpants and a hat with the fold-down earmuffs.
Belairs and other local extras say they'll keep meeting here every year for Groundhog Day. Opera House director John Sherris admits, in this case, life is trying to imitate art.
We live the movie here. I keep wondering what I have to do to redeem myself to get out of the loop, because every day is like somehow Groundhog Day here.
Here in Woodstock, organizers expect around 1,000 people to take part in the festivities, which continue through Sunday. For NPR News, I'm Jenna Dooley.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Switching gears now, we are turning to America's secular religion, football. It's Super Bowl Sunday coming up, and as you stock up on necessary supplies, your chili, your wings, your popcorn, your chips, finally, fashionistas have something to look forward to as well. Now they can stock up on their favorite team gear. Women make up 44% of the NFL's fan base, and recently the NFL launched the Fit for You campaign to better highlight new and improved women's apparel lines. Here to talk more with us about fashion and the Fit for You campaign is Rhiannon Madden. She is the director of apparel for the NFL. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So director of apparel means what?
That means I actually handle all of the apparel outside of the on-field. So any of the lifestyle apparel you see, whether you shop at Kohl's, Target, Old Navy, all of that stuff, I would have collaborated with our licensees on.
So off the field. I'm tempted to say the on-field outfits, but that wouldn't be the right... that's not yeah. what that's
The on-field uniforms.
Uniforms,
handled,
of course.
Yes, yeah. That's handled within my group as well, but I don't work as closely with
but
that.
But you do that. So when did this campaign start? I guess the question is really, how did you figure out that women would like their own stuff?
Well, we've actually been offering product for women for the past 10 years, but we hadn't communicated that well enough for people to know, so women didn't know where to buy it or that we even had it. So we realized, yeah, we have, as you said, 44% of our fan base is female. That's 80 million women. These are all individuals. They don't engage with the sport in the same way. So we looked at them and said, what can we do to be better for our fans? So we knew they shopped at all different places, wore different things, whether it was maternity, plus size, fitness products. We wanted to make sure that we had something for everyone.
So what's different about the women's apparel now? I think a lot of women, like me, who play sports or like sports, the only way you knew that something was for you was that it was pink.
Yeah, we call that shrinking and pinking. And listen, that some people that still appeals to. But we have a lot more women that want to be what we call loud and proud. That's our avid fan. Or we have women that want to be a little more casual about it and show it in a more subtle way.
Okay, but what about evening wear? Is there any NFL evening wear?
We do have some. We have very glitzy jewelry, which I'm actually wearing a piece of it right now. We have amazing...
Really? Tell me. Yeah. Describe.
I have on, it's a sterling silver necklace. I happen to be a Patriots fan. I love all the teams, but I happen to be a
Patriots
fan.
This interview's over. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Never mind. Okay. I'll try to pull it together. Okay.
It's got a really beautiful crystal bead. And we have a lot of jewelry like this. We have stackable rings, bangles, all types of stuff. So that to dazzle up your evening wear. We also have evening bags, like really cool clutches, really nice stuff.
Forgive me. Do regular people actually buy that stuff? Glam, blingy?
Yeah, you know what? I was surprised by it too, because we did take a chance and we have a really high-end handbag line. We have, you know, footwear that's a lot more high-end, and the consumers are out there and they've responded and they rock it. They look just as good and as the women of the NFL family. So absolutely.
Fashion these days often comes, how can I put it, bottom up as opposed to top down.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much about the designers telling people what they should wear as consumers somehow or another indicating what they want to wear and the market responding. So how would you describe this line? Do you think it's bottom up or top down?
I think it's a collaboration, really, because I think we do follow, because we want to see what they're interested in, and we want to create wearing occasions for our products. So it's a bit of both, I would have to say.
So what are you going to be rocking on Sunday for the big game?
I'm actually rocking. This is crazy. I'm wearing a full sequined Patriots jersey, and I'm not actually the type of girl that would wear sequins normally, but I just had to. It's just so off the charts, and I know it's going to get a lot of attention and for my Patriots. So that's what I will be rocking.
Okay, well, we won't be looking for you, but you know, I would say good luck, but I wouldn't mean it. So, but before I let you go, you know, I have to ask: are you related to the Madden?
I am not, but I get asked that. Actually, that's the third time I've been asked that today, without fail. I've worked for the NFL for actually almost 11 years, and I get asked every single day. No relation, though.
No relation. Not a bad name to have, though.
No, it's not. I probably should just go with it sometime.
All right. Well, what can we look forward to in the future? Are you working on something super secret? You could give us just a little hint about something that might be coming down the pike.
Well, for the Fashionista, we definitely have a lot coming out. We're going to be collaborating with some designers. We've been speaking to quite a few. So that's one thing. And then we also will have a real focus on fitness. A lot to look forward to.
Okay. Something to look forward to next year when the Giants are hoisting the Lombardi Trophy. Oh, sorry. Did I just say Rhiannon Madden is the director of apparel for the NFL, and she was kind enough to join us from member station WFYI in Indianapolis, which is hosting Super Bowl 46, which will be played on Sunday. Thank you so much.
Thank you.